Clark, who began his Civilization with a chapter called The Skin of Our Teeth on the precarious transition from classical to medieval, is an exception in that he gives full weight to the Irish contribution. Many historians fail to mention it entirely, and few advert to the breathtaking drama of this cultural cliffhanger. This is probably because it is easier to describe stasis, classical then medieval, than movement, classical to medieval. It is also true that historians are generally expert in one period or the other, so that analysis of the transition falls outside their, and everyone's, competence. At all events, I know of no single book now in print that is devoted to the subject of the transition, nor even one in which this subject plays a substantial part. In looking to remedy this omission, we may as well ask ourselves the big question. How real is history? Is it just an enormous soup, so full of disparate ingredients that it is uncharacterizable? Is it true, as Emile Choran has remarked, that history proves nothing because it contains everything? Is it not the reverse side of this, that history can be made to say whatever we wish it to? I think, rather, that every age writes history anew, reviewing deeds and texts of other ages from its own vantage point. Our history, the history we read in school and refer to in later life, was largely written by Protestant Englishmen and Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans. Just as certain contemporary historians have been discovering that such redactors are not always reliable when it comes to the contributions of, say, women or African Americans, we should not be surprised to find that such storytellers have overlooked a tremendous contribution in the distant past that was both Celtic and Catholic, a contribution without which European civilization would have been impossible. To an educated Englishman of the last century, for instance, the Irish were, by their very nature, incapable of civilization. "The Irish," proclaimed Benjamin Disraeli, Queen Victoria's beloved Prime Minister, "hate our order, our civilization, our enterprising industry, our pure religion." Disraeli's father had abandoned Judaism for the Church of England. "This wild, reckless, indolent, uncertain and superstitious race have no sympathy with the English character. Their ideal of human felicity is an alternation of clannish broils and coarse idolatry," i.e. Catholicism. "Their history describes an unbroken circle of bigotry and blood." The venomous racism and knuckle-headed prejudice of this characterization may be evident to us, but in the days of "dear old Dizzy," as the Queen called the man who had presented her with India, it simply passed for indisputable truth. Occasionally, of course, even the smug colonists of the little Queen's empire would experience a momentary qualm. Could the conquerors possibly be responsible for the state of the colonized? But they quickly suppressed any doubt and wrapped themselves in their impervious superiority. As in this response by the historian Charles Kingsley to the famine-induced destitution he witnessed in Victorian Ireland. "I am daunted by the human chimpanzees I saw along that 100 miles of horrible country. I don't believe they are
our fault.
Emphasis mine.
I believe that there are not only many more of them than of old, but that they are happier, better, and more comfortably fed and lodged under our rule than they ever were. But to see white chimpanzees is dreadful. If they were black, one would not feel it so much. But their skins, except where tanned by exposure, are as white as ours.
Nor can we comfort ourselves that such thinking passed long ago from the scene. As the distinguished Princeton historian Anthony Grafton wrote recently in the New York Review of Books, of history departments at the better American universities,